Philadelphia, down in that area.
But just tell me what your youngest son is doing. I'm sorry, your middle son.
Yeah. Well, he got a degree from Columbia in physics, captain of a football baseball team, and he decided he was going to work for himself. And the thing he was going to do was design furniture. Hmm. That chair you saw coming in the door was, when they built a set of chairs for someone, they always built a spare in case something happened. When he gave this to his mother, that chair is worth $20,000. So, and he has a pretty thriving business in New York City, dealing mostly with millionaires in Trump Tower and places like that who don't pay their bills. Mm-hmm. He's got that all kind of problem, you know. So that's the family makeup.
Boy, well, that's quite a saga for three sons.
Yeah, and they in turn have the youngest boy, the fellow who just promoted. He's got four sons. One of them is 8, and one of them is 1. They're 2. And they're in between, you know.
So you've got quite a brood.
Yeah, and then the number 2 boy adopted 2 children, and the number 1 boy has 2 daughters. One's a senior at Princeton, and Frank Jr. is on the board of directors at Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
Has been for a number of years, you know. He's on a couple of boards, you know.
He can make them a bit less theoretical.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he's a real practical problem solver. Yeah, all right, I will look at this. Won't take your time up now.
Okay, but that's a little thing we did with the Electrochemical Society.
Yeah.
The Electrochemical Society is one of... See, if you look on the back there, you see all the organizations which... It's really the chemical community.
Electrochemical Society in this country, it was an offshoot, was it not, of the English Electrochemical Society?
I don't think...
They called it the Faraday Society, didn't they?
The Faraday Society in the UK, that's right.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Which the Electrochemical Society in the United States, I've not... looked into this yet, but it's always surprised me. It was founded in Philadelphia, you know, which
I didn't know
kind
that.
Of seems a, you always have the mental imagery of Niagara Falls or something like that. But Philadelphia is where it started, like many another thing.
Well, I'm wondering about them. I will put this over here. Yeah.
Okay. I'd really like to start at the beginning and just
take over.
Just
yeah.
say this is an oral history interview with Frank Biondi on the 19th of March 1996 mm-hmm. as part of the Electrochemical Society's Oral History Project. And Mr. Biondi, can we just begin with a little bit about your own background, your family, your undergraduate career, and how you got into the chemical world?
Yeah, well, I was born and raised in the Allentown, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania area. And after graduating from high school, I worked for a year for Mack Trucks in order to earn some money to charge college. My father had come down with multiple sclerosis, and so I had a sort of shift for myself. But anyway, I ended up in the class of 36 at Lehigh in chemical engineering. Which at Lehigh means you take all the courses a chemistry student takes, plus the engineering courses, you know, heat engines and physics and metallurgy and things of this sort. So I had to make a choice when I was ready to graduate whether I should stay on and do some teaching and take a graduate degree there. And while I was thinking about it, the man I worked for, the professor I worked for, Harvey Neville, sent me down to New York to work for the Bell Laboratories on a summer job where his former roommate from Princeton, R.M. Burns, was the chemical director.
Okay.
So I took a job there for the summer, and before the summer ended, this is in 1936, someone who I didn't know, a chemist, died, and they decided to ask me to take the job. I was worried about my obligations to Leah. I said, don't worry, we'll take care of that. There's probably 10 people standing in line for that job right now. So it was sort of a job that didn't pay very much, but you could take all the courses you wanted free, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of thing. You took over for various professors, correct their papers, teach some of their courses, things of this sort. So I ended up at Bell Laboratories instead in 1936. Now, it happened that the Bell Laboratories hadn't hired any professional people since 1936, 7 years. And I didn't realize at that moment, but I realized later what a wonderful opportunity it was, because there was no one ahead of us for promotion and things of this sort. If you wanted a promotion, sometimes that's not a good deal, because it turned out later that I got promoted very early on, and I became a manager instead of being a chemical engineer. In fact, the Bell Lab didn't even realize I was a chemical engineer. They thought I was a chemist.
Yes, that was a little unusual. They weren't right. They'd be hiring chemists.
That's so. Right. And when I told them that I was not trained to be a chemist, I didn't want to be a chemist, and I was not going to be a scientist. I'm an engineer. Well, we'll put you into the Western Electric Company, but stay with us for a couple of years. You know, the Western Electric Company builds the equipment, and so there I was. The first thing I did was I registered at Columbia University for graduate work, and since I had to work at Bell Laboratories for the magnificent sum of $28 a week, I turned down a job in Philadelphia to take the job in New York, because I liked the idea of being in New York City, and their office at that time was down in the Greenwich Village section. Mm-hmm. I passed up a job with Sun Oil on Passyunk Avenue in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Maybe I'd have done better with them financially. But there I was. I found myself amongst an interesting group of people from two reasons. One, they hadn't added any new blood for 7 years. Secondly, the Bell Laboratories was formed by the AT&T Company and the Western Electric Company, a manufacturing outfit. By combining forces, people that were working with materials. So the AT&T people tended to be academic. The people they assigned to Bell Laboratories was what people were titled to be members of the R&D department, research and development department. The Western Electric Company just called their people engineers. And they put them in an old building down in New York City that Western Electric used. And you had two sets of people trying to solve the same problems. One was brand new, one was an old organization that wasn't going to give any grounds to these new academic types who were more interested in writing papers and attending meetings of the Electrochemical Society, amongst other things. They never wrote papers. All they did was they knew about materials from raw experience, and they compared three or four people trying to sell people. Salesmen told them how good their materials were, and then they made some tests, but they were not an academic organization. Now, I found myself in an academic part, but I was really interested in working for the other group, and this caused all kind of dislocations. I wasn't very happy about the spot I was in, so after I got the degree from Columbia, the master's degree in chemical engineering, I decided to take a PhD program at Columbia. I was just starting on that when a couple of physicists, Nobel Prize winners, came over to what they thought was a chemical department, but it was a chemical engineering department, and wanted to know if they had a young man who they could send over to the physics building where they were working on a secret program.
This is at Columbia.
At Columbia. Now, this turned out to be the Atom Bomb Project, the Manhattan District Project. At that time, the Germans and the Japanese and the English knew that if they took uranium ore, which is 0.7% uranium-235, which is what you want to pull out because it's unstable, the rest of it was 238, which was stable. That was a junk of the process. They all knew that if you dissolve this ore in hydrofluoric acid, you generated a liquid which, when heated, was a gas, uranium hexafluoride.
Mm-hmm.
And if you passed this, one technique to separate out the uranium-235 was to pass it between sheets of metal that had tiny little holes in them, and the lighter element had a longer mean-free path. And if you did this 20,000 times, they figured you would get from 0.7% U-235 80% to 90%, which they thought might make a bomb, you know. Well, I spent a couple of weeks, mind you, I was paid by Bell Labs. I was working at Columbia University on weekends and evenings on a PhD program. Hadn't picked out a thesis yet, a title. And after 2 weeks or so, I told them there were five Nobelists over at the physics building who were trying to act as engineers. Mm-hmm. This is a classical engineering problem, you see. This is like petroleum refinery engineering, except it was with a gas, you know, multiple stage things. I said to them as I left, they work with flat sheets like about a foot wide of nickel manganese alloy, and they dissolve the manganese out, leaving little holes, or small holes. And these two sheets were put opposite one another in some kind of a holder, which was made out of nickel, so the hydrofluoric acid wouldn't attack it. You had to be very careful not to let tiny amounts of water in, because that would leak hydrofluoric acid, you see. And what would happen if the pumps varied in their speed or shut down and started up, you know, a pulse went through this, and then stuff shattered. It was all full of holes. And they wanted me to do something about it so it was stronger, but don't change the dimension of the holes, you know, offhand. It doesn't, it's not reasonable to even try it, but I spent 2 weeks at it. And I tried various techniques, heat treating here, borrowing a furnace from somebody, rolling it, it all changed. And I told him, you're doing it the wrong way, you're doing it the hard way. Why don't you take that sheet and put a piece of cloth behind it and roll the whole thing up into a tube. That's much stronger, even though it's a weak material. And I went out to the men's room and got two pieces of bathroom tissue to show them how weak they were as flat. I rolled one up with a couple of pieces of scotch tape. It had reasonable strength. So they said, well, why don't you do that for you? Well, I said, you know, I'm trying to get a PhD here. I work for Bell Labs. Well, we'll talk to your people down there. We'll get a contract for Bell Laboratories to do this. And you can work on it down there in one of their office buildings. And I did it in a matter of, there were about five different ways to separate it. One of them was a gaseous diffusion program. That's the one I was going to work with. Another one was a thermal diffusion program. There was another one was ionized the material and separated in a mass spectrograph kind of a thing. And they started to build a plant down at Oak Ridge. You know, clear the ground, put in a power plant. They had the slightest idea where they were going to get this so-called gaseous diffusion barrier. This is all in the history of books that are laying over there, you see. I finally decided that the way to do this is to take nickel powder, which I got from Mon in Wales, where they take low quality nickel ores, and the way they extract the nickel was they expose it at high temperatures, ground up at high temperatures to carbon monoxide, and they make nickel carbonyl.
Yeah.
And then they decompose it, and you get a particle, a bunch of particles looked like, at high magnification, like a bunch of grapes. Mm-hmm. And this is great because you put a bunch of grapes together, you get a lot of tortuous paths. Oh. And what I did then, I mixed this all up in toluene with polystyrene. And then I rolled out a sheet and went down to the secondhand machinery area of New York City and bought a roller that operated on DC, so I had to get a DC connection. You know, modern labs don't have DC, but I found one lab where they were trying to come up with the first television system by mechanical means, a bunch of screens or something, rotating screens. And they had a circuit board that they could call on a generator down in the basement to give them anything up to a couple hundred volts DC. It was great. Maybe somebody was looking down from above, giving me all this handy stuff. Well, I found out I rolled a sheet, and then I had to get the plastic material out. And what I did was I built a furnace that would go up to about 1,000 degrees centigrade, and I borrowed some platinum from the metallurgy department to make the heating helmets around. And what I did, I put this flat plastic sheet containing mostly nickel and heated it up very gently in nitrogen. And as I heated it up, I decomposed, depolymerized the polystyrene. And then I shifted over to a hydrogen mixture, hydrogen and nitrogen. And then I sintered together these nickel particles. One had to be very careful in heating it up to chase out the organic material. You couldn't overheat it, because if you cracked it, you form carbon. And that, you can't remove that very easily unless you put a little water in the hydrogen. And so I didn't have chance, I couldn't go out and buy the kind of equipment you could buy today to make all these determinations and controls. I just had to use common sense. Maybe that's what engineering was in those days. I worked out a program where I could heat it up and produce this sheet about 2 feet long, about 8 inches wide, of pure nickel, centered together. It had considerably more strength than this manganese, the deprived nickel that they were using up at Columbia. And I would take little samples out, and we would measure the throughput and ability to separate a mixture of helium and carbon dioxide. And from that, we could calculate to what the heavier elements might do. Because we were not allowed to work with radioactive materials in a commercial building, and I didn't want to get involved with that part of it. I would send samples up to Columbia once a month, and they would measure it with the radioactive material and give me a number, the separation factor and the throughput. Because a good separation factor was no good unless there was volume going through it. They figured they needed a couple of hundred pounds of uranium-235, not milligrams, which all my competitors were making milligrams and grams of this stuff. And mind you, I was 26 years old at the time, and I had nobody with muscle behind me to represent me on the Columbia campus. Harold Urey, who was my boss up there, didn't think the whole thing was going to work in the first place, the whole business of designing the bomb and all that, you know, which I was not involved. But anyway, one after another, these programs fell apart, and they were actually thinking of scrapping the gaseous diffusion program because nobody could produce a barrier. We, the English, the Germans, or the Japanese, they're all working on it. And then somebody remembered, who's that young kid from Bell Labs who's up here? He sends us samples. They look pretty good, so let's see what. They took me up, plucked me in a physics building at Columbia. They told me to send all my stuff up to Columbia, which I did, because it was supposed to be owned by the government, including the $40,000 worth of platinum. It was the winding in my furnace. It was in a junk pile up there. They called a junk contractor in, and for so much, he picked it all up and threw it away somewhere in the dump. I tried to figure out how to get that $40,000 worth of platinum out. There's no way I could figure out how to do it. I wasn't a successful crook, you know. Didn't belong to me anyway. It belonged to the metallurgist who loaned it to me. So we had to finally pay them on the government contract for that $40,000 worth of platinum. The reason I use platinum is it's a very good heating element. And in those days, the war was on, and I couldn't get the standard heating alloys, like the thing you have in your toaster, except in bigger shape, because I didn't have the right priorities.
Yeah.
But I could get platinum. Nobody mind if I used platinum, you know. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, the Columbia people tried to reproduce what I was doing, and in the meantime, what I had done before I left Bell Laboratories, I took a sheet of this, three sheets about that long, spot welded them together, and made a tube out of it, of a 5/8 inch diameter, which I lured out of the window of the 6th floor building downtown to a colleague of mine who was waiting in a taxi cab on the sidewalk down below with the roof open. I couldn't take it out because the elevators just wouldn't fit. And people would ask questions, what is all this, you know? And I took it up to a meeting in Columbia, and they said, my God, it works. I had a piece of canvas, I rolled it up like, I had watched some people who were rolling their own cigarettes to see how they do it with this flimsy paper, you know? They back it up with a piece of cloth and a roller roller. And they thought, well, God, this guy can produce some material, it has the right kind of properties, it's rugged compared, you know, and it has a potential of producing pounds of stuff, not grams. And they were trying to figure out where they were going to do this when the chief engineer, which was Carbide, Union Carbide, came down and said, you academics, you're going to follow this whole thing up. We're taking it over. So they took us over. So I went to Niagara Falls where they had an installation up there where they were going to do this. And I taught them everything I knew. And what I didn't know in the meantime, my management at Bell Laboratories didn't want to be involved in this program. They didn't want anything related to a bomb that might kill people to be a product of the Bell Laboratories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what they did, they stopped pursuing 7 patents that I had pursued in the name of the government, a government-owned contract. But the Bell Laboratory Patent Department would apply for these patents. As a matter of fact, the man who was doing it turned out to be the best man at my wedding. And he isn't around anymore. But to make a long story short, the Bell Laboratories transferred all my patent applications to Union Carbide. And if you look in the history books, which is the black one, you find that some guy at Union Carbide, in the Bakelite Corporation, was the guy who invented the system I'm talking about. I was told to cut my ties with this atom bomb thing and get back to work at Bell Laboratories. That's what I was doing.
So when was that?
Oh, that must have been in, let me see. I decided to write a history of the things I had done.
Mm-hmm.
And this is in code. The code is my handwriting. I once won a $5 million case for AT&T because no one could read my handwriting in my notebooks. And if I were dishonest, I could say what I wanted to do about it. But actually, I was not dishonest. I read it. And the company that was violating our patents at that time was National Cash Register that AT&T bought 5 years later. Now, let me see. Early work, Manhattan District was a book. Went up there August of 41, so it must have been 42 or 3 that I got back to Bell Laboratories. Yeah, here it is, 42. I was 28 years old at that time. And by the way, before I left it, I went down to Washington and got a Secretary of War, Stinson, was in retirement, but he met me in the White House, shook my hands and gave me this piece of paper in this little tiny medal, and it says here, participated in work central to the production of the atom bomb, thereby contributing to the successful conclusion of World War II. This certificate is awarded in appreciation in August 1945.
Yeah. Wow, that's
very
fine.
He gave me a $1 bill and made me sign a receipt for it. Because that was all the government was going to pay for.
Yes.
You see, while all this was going on, the Bell Laboratories was paying my salary.
Yeah.
They decided it would be too complicated to have it work for them, you know.
Hmm.
Up here. Mm. Beat, but
Well, that's very interesting, complex chemical engineering, but it's a long way from electrochemistry.
Yeah,
isn't it?
In the meantime, you see this? I was an ordnance officer, and they wanted to call me up to duty. See, I'd been made a second lieutenant and a gentleman by an act of Congress. Did you know they do that? I didn't know it either. They not only make you an officer, but they make you a gentleman.
That's nice.
So, by act of Congress. Well, I keep that there in case some burglar comes in or something. So, here I was, and disconnected from this thing, What I didn't know is the material that was the junk from the process of separation, U-238, they sent out to Washington, state of Washington, where there was an installation, and they bombarded it in a carbon pile and stuffed some more neutrons in the nucleus and made plutonium, which is even better than uranium-235. Well, the gossip I had to finish this thing was that using my barrier at Oak Ridge, which they fitted in after everything was put there, they made enough material for 2.5 bombs. I didn't know about plutonium at that time. They used the first one in Trinity for a test. They didn't know it was going to work. In fact, they were afraid it might overwork. It would keep on going and destroy the whole state. Now, they actually talked about concerns. Yeah. When they worked at the University of Chicago under the Athletic Stadium where they had their laboratory, they were afraid it was going to take off and they couldn't control it. Fermi was there. He learned how to control it with the carbon rods. Well, anyway, the Trinity thing worked. That was about September, I think, but I wasn't quite sure. I wasn't involved in that phase of it. And while I was not supposed to know about it, in any big organization like that, there's always an underground information going on. The spies can steal everything that way, and they did it.
Yeah.
The Russians knew about it. We were living with a bunch of guys in New York who seemed to be more interested in Russia than they were in the USA.
Yes.
The Daily Worker was a paper they read. I read the Herald Tribune, which says one belly up. Anyway, they were able. In the meantime, they were designing the bomb, and they, as you know, dropped number one on Hiroshima, and then number two, which I didn't know about, was a plutonium bomb, and they never tested that. They dropped it. For the first time, that was the test. And it actually had another bomb built in that bomb in case it didn't work so it would explode the whole thing. And the Japanese at that time were still enemies, might get an advantage of where we were, you know. Well, we had enough then. We tested one bomb, we dropped one, we had a half a bomb's worth left over. If the Japanese had held tight, we'd have to work another 6 months before we could get enough to drop another one on them.
Yeah.
Well, that was all over. No, just to show how this thing works. My wife, she wasn't my wife at that time, she was in Atlanta working for an aircraft company, the B-29, which dropped the bomb.
Mm-hmm.
How's that? She called me up and said, President Truman has just announced they dropped something called the atomic bomb in Japan. Well, you know anything about it? And I said, gee, well, what makes you think I know something about it? Well, she said, you came down to visit me in Atlanta once, and you took me to a movie about Madame Curie, and you explained a lot of things. You seemed to know more about radioactivity than the average person. When this was announced, I figured that's what he was doing. See, I was in West Virginia at the nickel company making these things.
Yeah.
Well, so much of that history.
So, when you went back to Bell Labs...
I went back to Bell Labs and got into the electronics business, and things were really exciting in those days. One of the group I had worked with, which were all chemists, had moved to New Jersey. I didn't want to go to New Jersey in a new lab.
When was that move?
That was about... 43 or 4, but I can't put a good date on it. I stayed behind it and got into this. Across the street, there was a building where we designed and made electron or vacuum tubes. But at that time, we were up to our hips in trying to help the English with magnetrons for the defense of Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And the big problem was these magnetrons were built and shipped out with a PhD with each one of them, because each one of them was different, you know. wasn't like building cars, they were all alike. And then they had a tremendously short life, like 20 or 30 hours. Which maybe is all right if you're fighting a battle and you can get new people and new... But there was no long-term solution to the radar problem. The Russians, I mean, the Germans apparently didn't have radar at that time. And so the first job I was put on, see what you can do about this cathode, which is bombarded by these high voltage bombardment. And it was a sleeve of nickel, about like a pipe, about an inch in diameter, and this big one. Inside was a heater. And if you heat this nickel sleeve, the outside is coated with a mixture of barium and strontium carbonates, which you break down to the oxides, and then when you heat them up in a vacuum, you get little patches of barium and strontium metal, which reacts with some of the carbon coming out of the nickel sleeve and gives you a flow of electrons with the proper voltages on them to the cathode. And that back bombarder would blast that stuff off. So it had short life. So, mind you, I came from a place where I built something which was a sponge. So I went right back to Columbia and got a pound of the metal and made a sponge of the nickel metal on the solid nickel anode. And then put these carbonates in the holes. So, and then when they were reduced to the oxides and the metals in the vacuum, the back bombardment didn't affect them nearly as much. And we got a couple hundred hours in a matter of a month. So I became an expert. I didn't even know which end of the tube to plug in. You know, this is just common sense. And so the electron tube guy said, hey, you know, we need a guy like you over here. So I moved my office from the main building over to this, it's an old biscuit factory they were in, and I had all kind of problems, which I loved because they were real problems, you know. I wasn't going to write a paper and publish it in Electrochemical Society, which all the people I left seemed to, it was sort of a graduate school. And that's one of the reasons they weren't succeeding with the other half of the crowd, which came from the factories, who never read a paper, never published one, couldn't care less. They wanted to know how did it work. And this is where the two people... I found out when I got over there, for example, everybody who designed a tube designed a cathode. Hello? Yeah, you take it, Jenny? Good, thanks. So here was, these were mostly electrical engineers and a few physicists who took the wrong road somewhere and became practical people rather than theoretical people. I made an analysis. There were something like 20 different analyses of nickel to be used to make vacuum tubes with. Each one who designed a new vacuum tube said, that's my composition. They were even secretive about the damn thing. So I looked at it and decided what they really wanted was somebody wanted a highly active nickel, had a lot of carbon in it, they came out and reduced the strontium, oxide to strontium, for example. Then there was the, if it was a weak performer, very little amount of carbon or other tungsten, for example, there's a whole range of these things, you would get long life. However, if you wanted a tube to go into the broadcast business or into the business of the magnetrons, you wanted something that gave you a high activity, and high activity is generally associated with low life. You know, low activity, long life. Now, in the telephone business, the whole activity was generally for long life. And in those days, if tubes lasted 20,000 hours, I thought that was great, like 2 or 3 years. I thought that was pretty bad, you know. But the interesting thing about it was that I went to I went to ASTM at that point. You know them in Philadelphia?
Yeah.
And said, I joined their committee B4, which is on heating alloys. And then it was in that committee that, at my suggestion, we standardized on three alloys of nickel for the electron tubes. I did this because it would make it, the Bell system bought a small amount of the total needed in the country. People making tubes for radios. That was just before the days of television, but the radio business was a big business. They bought their stuff by the ton. We bought it by the pound, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And if we could get what we wanted to be used by everybody, it would be in our interest. And I sold my medicine on this. And they said, go pursue it. Then I thought about, the problem is they worked by committee. There was a glass committee. If we wanted to be sure to have a specification describing what the glass we use in our electron tubes was, we had to go to the glass committee, which was interested in windows,
mm-hmm.
primarily, glass bottles. And, but they had to write this thing, so we didn't get very much. When we wanted steel rods, we had to go to the steel committee. They were interested in railroad tracks. So I went to the board of ASTM and said, why don't you start a new set of committees instead of a committee for each type of material? How about a committee for all the materials for our industry? And they agreed to it. And we organized the first one called the F committees, F1,
mm-hmm.
for all the materials for the electronics industry. I remember F2, I think, was all the materials for the surgical industry. Now that's a big deal. They had never thought of that idea.
Mm-hmm.
And if we wanted to write a standard on steel to be used, or tungsten to be used, or glass to be used, we did it. We the people in the electronics industry, not a bunch of other people who regarded this as a nuisance.
Yes.
You see? So you get to see the pattern. I was the organizer. And as soon as I got that organized, I dropped out of ASTM. They wanted me on their board. I said, no, I got other fish to fry. In the meantime, I'd gotten married, and children were coming along, and I got involved in community affairs, you know. You see, I was mayor of the town, you can see. And I was chairman of the board of a 450-bed hospital. So...
you lived a quiet life.
Yeah. My wife complained about it because she had to take care of the family. You know? Can't see if she's in here.
Jenny?
Yeah.
Here, hang on. Come on in, I'll introduce you.
This is Arnold Thackeray.
Hi, Jenny. As we're having a good conversation here.
yes, nostalgia.
Seems to have been a busy man.
In those days he was, very. He spent a great deal of time at the ASTM.
Yeah, in the early days, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which ran the hospital in the evening, was that?
Well, that started in 1956. That was the year our third son.
Totally. We were both involved in community affairs. She was on a planning board and things of the sort.
Yeah. Plus, we had three boys in Little League and basketball and football. You know the story.
Well, I was one of three boys myself, so I know how that works from a mother's point of view.
It was great. I grew up with three brothers, so I enjoyed having the three boys. But... it goes by much too fast.
Yeah.
I mean, there, the oldest one is 51, and the youngest is 39. So, you know, I keep thinking of them as the boys, but they're far from that.
Yeah.
Well, I've enjoyed being here. Sit down and resume your conversation.
As a matter of fact, there's a picture on the Columbia campus. The building I was working in is right over here, mm-hmm. outside the picture. You know, they're now trying to collect $1 billion.
Oh, yes.
And they suddenly discovered I went to school there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you asked a question there. Yeah. So.
That your position in Bell Labs was...
Well, as soon as I got to this, over into this building where the people designed electron tubes, they remembered they had a chemist somewhere in the building. They got him and I became a supervisor. Mm. Before you know it, I had 4 or 5 people. So I was concerned about them, seeing they were on the good programs, and I was starting to let go of doing things with my own hands, which I didn't like very much, because here I am, just out of school a few years, and before you know it, I was doing things that I wasn't trained to do. I wasn't trained to be a manager. Mm. And I didn't like it very much, you know. Merit radios and rate radios and hiring people. In my 43 years with Bell Labs, I hired 90 PhD-trained, mostly chemists and metallurgists and electrochemists, things like this. Right? I fired 2 of them out of 90. And to get those 90, I had to look at 900 of them. 10-1 was a ratio. See, we had a system, people from all the universities in the country and even overseas, looked at graduate students in their first year, and kept track with them for 2 or 3 years, so by the time they're ready to graduate, we had all kind of information on these people. Mm-hmm. It was a real good system.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a recipient of that. Other people would interview them, and they finally got down to the point where they thought I ought to make it an offer. I would then interview the person, you know. In the last couple of years I was there, it was really bad. In my last 2 years, I didn't see a single Caucasian boy. Mm-hmm. They were all Orientals.
Yes.
Most of them didn't even speak English.
Yeah.
And, but they were apparently bright people. I hired 2 or 3 of them, especially one electrochemist to hire, Yutaka Okinaka, a Japanese boy, very bright. And he did very well for us. And he was given awards by the Electrochemical Society. And Dennis Turner, who you talked mm-hmm. to, I pulled him out of the chemistry department, brought him over into, I was no longer in the chemistry department, I'm now over in applied groups. By that time I was in the transistor business, because shortly after the war ended, about 1948, I sat next to Bill Shockey, who got the Nobel Prize, you know, for he and 2 others. I lived amongst the physicists, not amongst the chemists. They regarded me as a different person because I wasn't a chemist. There is a lack of ability for physicists and chemists to talk to one another.
Yes.
And but I had sort of carved out a spot amongst the physicists where they would talk to me. In fact, they did most of their work, other than the theoretical work, in my laboratories. Now, my people helping them. By that time, I probably had about 40 people working for me. So we dropped the tube work and got involved in the early days of germanium. Of course, germanium isn't used anymore. And by the way I'm organizing, you can see I edited a couple of volumes. Transistor Technology was the first publications. Well, yeah. Actually, the first one was a secret manual. The Army came in and decided that they didn't want anybody to know about this thing that we call a transistor.
Yes.